that our collective decision to not gather on these summer-long weekends has been a life-giving one for people, that you did go for a walk or a swim or a something, that went outside. I know it's not always that simple, and I sometimes think that the things that we think of as our right to recreation are, they're worth thinking about. There's in fact not a right. It's a privilege. But I hope some of us were able to take advantage of those privileges and that they soaked into our body, mind, and spirit in good ways. We have been digging around in the topic of fear in ways that are connected from week to week, but I want to reassure you that, at least from my vantage point, I'm working hard to have each of those explorations stand on its own or contain sort of a review where they're connected, so even if you haven't been at a gathering for a while, you don't feel like you're starting the story in the middle in some way. Personally, I've been motivated in this exploration by my experience of having one conversation after another with folks for whom fear is a major feature of their lives. And I've learned that there are many things that we can look to as responsible for our experiences of feeling afraid. Some of those things are things we might call logical. They're the kind of things that would produce fear in anyone. We're going to blow you up before you blow us up rhetoric on the news every day, I think, you know, makes a little churn in anybody. Many of those sorts of features of the world around us produce a fear response in us for evolutionary reasons. They assail our sense of confidence in the realms we tend to look to for an experience of personal security. The physical realm, the emotional, the relational, the spiritual, they crash into our sense of whether those things can be counted on or not, and that tends to produce a fear response. And when that happens, we feel uncertain. And generally speaking, as human beings, we do not like to feel uncertain. That runs pretty deep in us. And so we tend to try to make it go away. And if that doesn't work, the next step, if you will, is usually to try to figure out how to live with it, what to do with that feeling of uncertainty. And just a little bit of a sidebar, I want to try to remember to say this to whoever gathers while we're talking about fear every week. But when I'm talking about fear, I am not talking specifically about what we might clinically call anxiety, about what Arielle talked about being her life experience. There's often a perceivable and an important relationship between those two experiences, but this is not meant to be an exploration of anxiety in particular. Some of us in this community experience and perhaps live daily with the clinical version or nameable version of anxiety, but all of us experience fear. That's more the terrain, okay? And because this is a community that exists to explore what we believe, I should also say that for many people I talk with, there is a kind of difficult, sometimes toxic, part of the experience of fear that has to do with their faith. That experience often seems to be about having been taught that faith is the opposite of fear. Yeah. If you have faith, you won't be or you shouldn't be afraid. It's often been presented to people as, or just implicitly understood as, an either or item of faith, and either or thinking when it comes to spirituality doesn't tend to work very well. It's kind of a spirituality killer. Because, among other things, in that sort of a system of belief, if you feel afraid, what are the available options? Well, denial is an option. If you want to either understand yourself as a person of strong faith in God or to be perceived as a person of strong faith, but faith and fear have been said to be incompatible, then you better not admit to being afraid. And this, by the way, is one of those places where mental health and spirituality has frequently overlapped in a not helpful way. What happens in that kind of a frame of belief if your experiences of fear don't respond well to willing them to go away? What's the message that ends up getting sent? First of all, to yourself. This is rather significant. First of all, to yourself, and then to any community that operates with that sort of a system of belief. Well, the message that ends up getting sent is that the problem must be you. It couldn't possibly be God. And if we're not inclined to entertain the possibility that there might be something wrong with the system of belief that's behind the whole dilemma, then that just leaves you. Your faith isn't strong enough. You need to get clear about what God or God's word or God's anointed or blah, blah, blah says about not being afraid. You need to repent of your fear. Anybody ever heard that one? You need to turn back to God, so on and so forth. What the perspective that I've been describing for the last couple of minutes pretty much utterly ignores is the very real possibility that whatever we're using God language for represents our perspective. So when the Bible says, God says, for instance, it's the writer's way of saying, my understanding or perception of God leads me to believe that God would say, which takes up a lot more print, but opens into a very different set of things. For some of us in this room, that idea falls under, well, duh. And for others of us in this room, that's a rather dramatic thing to consider. So, for all sorts of reasons, what I want to do this morning is take classical biblical text about this idea that if you trust God, you shouldn't be afraid, and I want to have a little bit of a look at it. And this is a classic. If you Google biblical texts about not being afraid, this one will be in the list. It may well be at the top. Other than the 23rd Psalm. But now, this is what the Lord says. He who created you, Jacob, he who formed you, Israel, quote, do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have summoned you by name. You are mine, close quote. That's Isaiah 43, first verse. So there are lots of other examples of don't be afraid verses, but this is a frequent go-to, so I want to work with it for a little bit. So if you grew up around biblical interpretation in church, and especially if that's mostly what the guy, and it would be the guy, at the front of the church did on Sunday morning, then some of what I'm about to do might feel kind of familiar. So here we go. So the first thing is, we should spend a little bit of time thinking about the context for the verse. Don't run for the exit yet. The verse starts out with, but now, in the English translation I'm working with, and that suggests, among other things, that we should pay attention to what came before, but now, right? So, in this particular case, what precedes but now, especially in the last half of the previous chapter, is this list of all the ways that the nation of Israel has been acting, you know, religiously blind, dumb, and stubborn. Like, it's just this litany of failures to step up. And if you want to get a fuller version of the writer's perspective, the writer of Isaiah's perspective, you could read this text in what's called the Amplified Translation, which is a version of the Bible that uses a wider variety of possible English words or phrases to represent the original language. And in that translation, the phrase, but now, reads, in spite of past judgments for Israel's sins. That's a rather thoroughgoing expansion of but now. But it does reference that what's come before, this list of failures. Now, if you were here the last time we met, you might recall that I touched on the origins of the myth of human morality, this idea of original sin, the idea that we're all fundamentally morally broken as a result of a generational curse, and that's our shared human moral inheritance. For the author of the Amplified Bible, that perspective is clearly alive and well in this text, and fair enough. The writer of Isaiah seems to think that failure to do what God wants is a good explanation for human suffering, and in particular for the suffering of Israel. So, to put this text into a bigger framework, it's important for us to remember that it was written to a nation that is really suffering. They have been militarily overthrown. They've been tossed out of their country. They have been moved by force to another place where they're living as exiles, which in the time frame, if we wanted to put that into 21st century parlance, they're sort of like a mixture of prisoners of war and conflict refugees and slaves. So it's heavy going. So naturally enough, as human beings in that situation, they have big, compelling questions about why this is happening to them. It's also worth remembering that this is a nation whose origin story is that they are a people that belong to the one God that rules over all the other gods. And as these sorts of ancient stories tend to go, that God has to be all-powerful or they can't possibly be the top God, right? There could be a God more powerful and that would undo the whole story. And if their God is all-powerful, then they are responsible for whatever happens. That's what an inclusive idea like all-powerful entails. And that means, among other things, that it would be best to keep God as happy as possible because, among other things, your survival depends on it. Because there are a lot of things that could undo you as humans that are, you know, are beyond your control. If God is all-powerful, they're within the control of God. Got to make the connection somehow and get God to do the thing that needs done, or you're going to die. So what do you do to make an unfathomable but all-powerful being happy? Just try to imagine what you might do if you're thinking about the divine this way. Well, the most obvious available path is that you bring your A game. You give them the best that you have, right? You give them your ritual devotion, whatever shape that takes. You give them your obedience. You give them your best stuff, in this case, crops, herds. You give them your babies. That might sound over the top, but it's just a part of the same continuum. And if you feel like that one's over the top, then just read this story about God supposedly asking Abraham to sacrifice his son. That, by the way, is a story that's not about what it appears to be about on the surface. And no, I don't think I mean it. It's really about Jesus. But the idea... We'll get to that another day. But the idea that people might think their God was asking you to sacrifice your child to them was not a culturally weird one at the time of this text being generated. Because that's the picture of the divine we're working with. All powerful, starts out pissed off, not happy, because gods seem to behave like that in the ancient realm, and needing to be negotiated with, placated, soothed, sacrificed to, whatever it takes, because everything's at stake. And the upshot of that perspective on the divine is that if things are going well, you must be giving the God what they want. And if things are going sideways, it must be because you are not giving them either what they want or not giving them enough of it. Because that's how the system's set up. And that perspective is all normal for the people Isaiah is writing to, for the writer, for Isaiah. Well, there's a very large problem with this perspective, which could be summed up by saying that shit happens. That's shorthand. In this world, the difficult, the tragic, the shattering things happen. And if we continue under the ancient understanding that this must mean that God needs to be placated, then the problem, or the reason behind the suffering, must be something we're either not doing, doing wrong, or not doing enough of. That's the way the system is set up. Now, I want to connect that to the fear versus faith issue. So if you're suffering with fear, and make no mistake, living with fear is suffering, then, under this sort of a system of belief, the problem is yours. If you have fear that your faith in God won't banish, the problem must be that you are doing something that makes God unhappy or not doing enough of what makes God happy. So, How does the writer of the book of Isaiah address that problem? Well, in this text, the writer of Isaiah addresses that problem by reminding the people of their origin story and by reinforcing the idea that if they will just accept that storyline and live into it, all will be well, right? So to go back to the text, he who created you, Jacob, he who formed you, Israel. In other words, God, the God that has given us our identity as a nation, is still the top dog. And if we would just get it together and live by that story, we'll get our nation, we'll get our autonomy back. The story will go right side up. And who wouldn't want that? There's lots here to explore, but I introduced an idea 2 weeks ago that I said I'd come back to, and it applies to what we're already exploring, so I'm going to return to it at this point. So this idea was from the Polish sociologist and philosopher Zygmunt Bauman. And here's the idea, as I presented it then. A little bit of a review for those of us that weren't around. Bauman suggests that there are two crucial values for human life. One is security, which is feeling safe. The other is freedom, which is the ability to self-assert, the ability to do what we really want to do. Bauman suggests that security without freedom is slavery, and freedom without security is chaos. Now, when I first said this a couple of weeks ago, I was watching people's response, and there was somebody sitting in the room who was like doing the if-then thing with their hands. If this, and they were trying to sort it out. And then when I said it, I stumbled it. I really butchered it pretty bad, despite having it right in front of me in writing. And so I want to try again. Okay, so this is my do-over. I'm going to review this because it's an important set of ideas. It's an interesting way to look at this. So Bauman suggests these two values that are crucial, he would just say fundamental for human life, security and freedom. If I have security, I feel safe. If I have freedom, I feel like I can do what I really want to do, which includes the freedom to believe what I want to believe. If I have security, but not freedom, if I have what I need, but I can't do what I want to do, I'm enslaved. If I have the freedom to do what I want to do, but I don't feel safe or secure, I'm living in chaos. Security without freedom equals slavery. Freedom without security equals chaos. I don't know if that helped any of you, but I'm feeling a lot better about how I presented that this time. Thank you. Thank you so much. That's what I was fishing for, was that. Right there. One way to think about the human endeavor is that what we're looking for in our human actions and experiences, we're looking for the best blend of those two values. So a life that's not at, if we think of those as poles on a continuum of human experience, a life experience that's not at either end. We neither have complete security with complete lack of freedom, nor complete freedom with complete lack of security. It's interesting. That's a complex idea, right? Because the mix that's required is deeply situational, deeply contextual. What the perfect blend would be like is not a constant in this idea. This is one of the reasons, folks, why we are uniquely vulnerable to leaders that say, give me the power and I will take responsibility for your future. Is there anyone in the world saying any such thing? And this is not just true for political leaders. This is true for every kind of leader, including religious leaders. And it's also true of narratives. It's also true of religious narratives, like the one that we're looking at this morning. The people that Isaiah is writing to are on the ropes. They are suffering. They are trying as hard as they can to make sense of the situation. They are trying with every bit of their collective being to fit what's happening with their perspective on who God is and how the relationship between the divine and the human works. And Isaiah is saying the way it works is that God owns you. I have redeemed you, like to redeem a coupon. So stop wandering off the storyline and things will come back around. The interesting thing, if you look at the wider story, the language that often gets used is the language of faithful and unfaithful. Faithful is a very interesting word. It's actually what it says, happy surprise, full of faith. To be unfaithful is to not be full of faith. faithful of faith. But they get used as a binary in the story lots of times. You're either faithful or you're unfaithful. It's more like the way we would use it regarding keeping a vow. This is language shows up in our culture typically around relational commitments, right? You were faithful to your wife or your husband. You were unfaithful to your wife or your husband. It's a all or nothing kind of language. To put that into the framework of security and freedom, it's like Isaiah is saying, if you want this story to come right, make sure that God knows that you know that God is in charge. That's the give me the power part. And God will take care of your future. Just behave and don't be afraid. So, that's recognizably an ancient perspective on God-human relations, right? Like, that's that frame of all-powerful top-dog God needs to be kept happy or the fur's going to be in the fan. In terms of addressing the fear experience, I would say that that's a potential recipe for exchanging one kind of slavery for another. You want your nation back? You want your security back? Do what I want you to do, and I'll give it to you, and you can stop being afraid. Want to feel like your world, all the world around you is secured? Believe right, behave right, and I'll take care of your future. Believe right, behave right. According to whom? See, it's not satisfactory for the answer to that question to be according to God. Because when Isaiah says, God says, Isaiah is writing as Isaiah. Isaiah is saying, my take on it is that this is the way the divine and the human operate. My best shot at this is that God says, I own you, behave, the story will come right. But then there's the last part of this particular little text, which says, as I read it to us, I have summoned you by name. That's potentially a fair bit more relational than I own you. And it goes with, in this particular text, it goes with the word but at the start of the text. And what it does is it kind of retells the whole story inside of the text from the story I've been telling about it to something more like this. Live like you belong to God, and God will stop being mad, and the situation will improve. So far, that's kind of the story we've been telling. But what the but and the I have summoned you by name does is it adds to that this. Live like you belong to God, and God will stop being mad, and the situation will improve, no matter what you might have already done. That's that whole last chapter, half of the chapter before, the litany of what you've already done. All the bad things that pissed God off, right? So when I come to a text like this, I feel like I can feel the struggle between these values of believe and behave and all will be well, security, and I'm with you no matter what you believe and whether you behave or not, freedom. I feel like I can hear the gears grinding in the human story. Just this. Like this, I don't have a good singular metaphor, but this the frustration as well as the engagement, the intrigue as well as the fear, the terror of how do we think about human-divine relations in a way that allows us to imagine, given a certain situation, the best possible blend of this tension between security and freedom. So we talk about trusting God. Well, that's great. Let's trust God. Well, who are we trusting? So the word God doesn't really do the job. We kind of have to define our terms. So who's shot on who God is, shall we trust? Yours, mine, everybody's, our churches, conventional Christianities? Progressive Christianities, the one that feels like it's resonant for me today. See what I'm saying? It's complicated, right? It will not do to simply answer the question of How do you deal with fear? To say, trust God. It's not a bad idea. It's just not that simple. It's not placate the angry being in the sky and the story will turn right. And just in case we think this is all an ancient story about a nation that we are not a part of ethnically, I don't know that anyone in the room this morning would make that claim in a direct way. All we have to do is check out, on any given day, the world news about the conflict in the Middle East to see how it's going. Like, it doesn't seem like that story can get turned right. So maybe Isaiah's paradigm about how that should happen has some issues. Are they understandable issues? Yeah. Are they a lot like our issues? Yeah. Is this story still unfolding? Yeah. So we just need to not make the mistake when we start to think about spirituality and fear that what we're looking for is math. We're not actually looking for an equation by which we can manage the divine in such a way that the divine comes and sweeps away the things that are our challenges. Which means we need to look for a different way to imagine the divine present in our challenges if we wish to have faith and fear. Because that perspective that Isaiah presents of just do what I tell you to and I'll take care of your future is demonstrably not the last word in human and divine interaction. It just hasn't. It didn't work then. You keep reading the story. It doesn't work. The nation Israel can't seem to keep God happy by that set of rules well enough for them to get back their land and their greatness and so on and so forth. Doesn't ever stick. Historically, doesn't work. Personally, doesn't work. Collectively, I have yet to see a demonstration of this being an adequate way to think about human-divine relations. But what about that other part? What about the I'm with you no matter what part? The part that for me makes it feel like the gears of evolving understanding of human-divine relationships are grinding, even in this story, that it's happening even in this story, that the writer of the book of Isaiah is wrestling with this thing while he writes. That on the one hand, he just wants this origin story of keep the rules that God gave us and it's going to be awesome to work. And on the other hand, he knows that that's not doing it, that that's not cutting it, and there's got to be more to the way this operates than that. That's the unfolding part. What about the unfolding part? Is that still unfolding? Is it unfolding in your imagination, in my imagination? These are not rhetorical questions for me, because I think we get to choose whether we'll engage with this. Or would we rather have someone tell us what to believe, to tell us how the story goes so we can just behave that and hand off our responsibility for the future? Zeke, the story you told, you know, right? Like there's a microcosm of this. We just walk past that dilemma and something inside of us goes, clunk, this isn't quite settled. This isn't right. Doesn't undo the good experience we had. It doesn't take the goodness out of the good, but it says that goodness isn't spilling over into enough things yet. We're not done. This is still evolving. This is still unfolding. Steve, your story about working up north and that project that you mentioned a couple of weeks ago in community time, I can't get that one out of my head. We could keep going, right? This is still unfolding. It's going somewhere, but it's still unfolding. And if we want to, we can choose systems of belief that are binaries, that behave like that. We can say, this is who God is, this is how God operates, these are the rules. And we can say to ourselves, to others around us, if you just keep that set of rules, the God will be happy, and because the God is powerful, you're gonna have security. But you have to keep these rules. I just described slavery, by the way. Okay? It's security without freedom is slavery. Whether it's physical or in a system of belief. Or, if we're willing to move away from the polarization of those values, then we're left with some really complicated questions, right? They're our questions to wrestle with. Are we going to keep exploring what we believe? Are we going to keep wrestling with the implications of what we're exploring in our context? Are we going to keep working personally and collectively, however we can imagine to do, however we can find the energy and time to do, toward the best possible blend of security and freedom for now, for here, for where we have some agency, some freedom, the ability to do what we will? What are we going to do with that freedom? I don't think we get to hand this off to God. You don't have to share that belief. This is not that kind of place. This is not my pastor believes, so I have to believe X. God have mercy. That should not happen. But that's what I believe. I don't believe we get to hand this project off. I also don't believe we're in it alone. I believe it's a blender. I believe it's a fascinating, intriguing, hard to put words around blender where God is everywhere present, including in the things that are so clearly not done yet. And that when we engage in the complex struggle of looking for the perfect blend of security and freedom, for instance, we are doing not just the work of God as though it were an assignment, but work together with God. This is what, another day again, but this is what Paul's on about more than anything else in his writings in the New Testament, that the new home of the divine, the new temple of the divine is in this room. It's us. Unfolding idea about where God lives. God doesn't live somewhere else. God's not handing it off in the thick of it, in the midst of the complexity of it. Next week, we're going to talk a little bit more about what happens when systems break or break down. And so, there you go. You can either look forward to that or not. You can go to the beach. I hope to see some of us together next week. Peace.